I went to Gulfaga. Trude Utziadur had spoken those words. The girl had acted like a fool, but her instinct had been right.
Clever and brave to venture to the buried city.
Kaliba regarded her.
It would be pleasant to have company in my bower, since I am denied the sisterhood of the priory, and since you already have most of the truth, I see no harm in telling you the rest.
I would treasure the knowledge.
No doubt, of course, Kaliba mused. To understand my power, you would have to know the whole truth of Sidon and the two branches of magic. And Mita has so little understanding of such things.
She keeps her daughters in the dark, draped in the comfort of well-worn books. All of you are soaked in ignorance. My knowledge, true knowledge, is a valuable thing. This was the next move in a game. One might say it was priceless, Iad agreed.
I paid a price for it, as must you.
At last, Kaliba approached. Water beaded from her hair as she walked around Iad.
I will take a kiss, she whispered at her ear.
Iad stayed rooted in place.
I have been alone for so many years. A kiss from you, sweet Eirdas, and my knowledge is yours.
A metallic scent hung on her skin. For a sudden eldritch moment, Iad felt something in her blood, something vital, sing in answer to that scent.
Lady, Iad murmured,
how will I know that what you say is the truth?
Do you ask the same of me to Yadanya, or does she receive your unconditional trust?
Receiving no answer, Kaliba said,
I give you my word that I will speak true. When I was young, a word was a sworn oath. It has been many years since then, but I still respect the ancient ways.
There was no choice but to risk it. Steeling herself, Iad leaned close to her and placed a kiss on her cheek.
There,
Kaliba said. Her breath was icy. The price is paid. Iad drew back as fast as she dared. She forced down a sudden thought of Sabran.
There are two branches of magic, Kaliba began.
The sunlight picked out threads of gold in her hair and limned each drop of water.
The sisters of the priory, as you know, are practitioners of Sidon, terrene magic. It comes from the core of the world and is channeled through the tree. Those who eat of its fruit can wield its magic. Once there were at least three Sidon trees. The orange, the hawthorn, and the mulberry. But now, to my knowledge, only one remains. But Sidon, dear Eirdas, has a natural opposite. Sidereal magic, or Seren, the power of the stars. This kind of magic is cold and elusive, graceful and slippery. It allows the wielder to cast illusions, control water, even to change their shape. It is far harder to master.
Iad no longer had to feign her look of curiosity.
When the long-haired star passes, it leaves behind a silver liquid. I named it Star Rot,
Kaliba said.
It is in Star Rot that Steren lives, just as it is in the fruit that Sidon lives.
It must be rare.
Unspeakably so. There has not been a meteor shower since the end of the Grief of Ages. And understand, Eirdas, that the shower was the end of the Grief of Ages. It was not a coincidence that it came where the worms fell. The Easterners believe the comet was sent by their dragon god, Quiriki.
Kaliba smiled.
The shower closed an era when Sidon was stronger and forced the worms, who were made of it, into their slumber.
And then Steren was the stronger, Iad said.
For a time, Kaliba confirmed. There is a balance between the two branches of magic. They keep one another in check. When one waxes, the other wanes. An age of fire will be followed by an age of starlight. At present, Sidon is much stronger, and Steren is a shadow of itself. But when a meteor shower comes, then Steren will burn bright again. The world had ridiculed alchemists for their fascination with the Tablet of Rumalabar, but for centuries they had been circling the truth. And truth it was. He had felt it in the lining of her belly, in the strings of her heart. She would not have believed it from Kaliba alone, but her explanation formed the thread that held the beads together. The long-haired star, the Tablet of Rumalabar, the fall of the worms in the grief of ages, the strange gifts of the woman who now stood before her. All of it connected. All of it stemming to one truth. Fire from beneath, light from above. A universe built on this duality. The Tablet of Rumalabar speaks of this balance, Eid said, but also what happens when the balance is unsettled.
Too much of one doth inflame the other, and in this is the extinction of the universe, Kaliba recited, a dire warning. Now, what, or who, is the extinction of the universe?
Eid shook her head. She knew the answer well enough, but best to play the fool. It would keep the witch off her guard.
Oh, Eadaz, you were doing so well.
Still, Kaliba said,
you were young. I must not be too hard a judge.
She turned away. As she moved, her hand came to her right side. It was as smooth and unmarked as the rest of her, but her gait betrayed the pain in it.
Are you hurt, lady? Ead asked.
Kaliba did not reply.
Long ago, the cosmic duality was upset, was all she said.
Ead thought she glimpsed something terrible in those eyes, a shadow of hatred.
Steren grew too strong in the world, and in return, the fire beneath our feet forged an abomination, a miscreation of Sidon.
The extinction of the universe. The nameless one, Ead said.
And his followers. They are children of the imbalance, of chaos.
Kaliba seated herself on a boulder.
Successive prioresses have long seen the connection between the tree and the worms, but denied it to themselves and their daughters. Mages can even create draconic flame during ages of fire, like this one. But, of course, you are forbidden from using it.
All sisters knew they had the potential to make worm fire, but it was not taught. Your illusions come from Steren, Ian murmured, so Sidon burns them away.
Sidon and Steren can destroy each other in particular circumstances, Kaliba conceded, but they also attract one another. Both forms of magic are drawn to themselves most of all, but also to their opposites.
Her dark eyes were alight with interest.
Now, my puzzle solver. If the orange tree is the natural channel of Sidon, what are the natural channels of Steren?
He had thought on it. The dragons of the east, perhaps? From what little she knew about them, they were creatures of water. It was a guess, but Kaliba smiled.
Very good. They were born of Steren. When the long-haired star comes, they can give dreams and change their shapes and knit illusions.
As if to demonstrate, the witch cast a hand down the length of her own body. All at once, she wore an innish gown of brown samite and a girdle studded with carnelians and pearls. Jewel lilies opened in her hair. Had the nakedness been the illusion, or was this?
Long ago, I used my fire to reshape the star rot I had gathered.
Kaliba combed her fingers through her hair.
To create the most remarkable weapon ever made.
Ascalon.
A sword of Steren, forged with Sidon, a perfect union. It was when I beheld it, the sword I had made from the tears of a comet, that I knew I was not just a mage. Her mouth flinched. The Priory calls me witch for my gifts, but I prefer enchantress. It has a pretty ring to it.
Ead had learned more than she had bargained for, but she had come to ask about the jewel. Lady, she said. Your gifts are miraculous indeed. Did you ever forge anything else from Steren?
Never. I wanted Ascalon to be unlike anything in this world. A gift for the greatest knight of his time, of course.
Kaliba said. That is not to say that there are no other objects, but they were not cast by my hand. And if they exist, they are long since lost.
It was tempting to tell her about the jewel, but it was best that Kaliba remained ignorant of it, or she would go out of her way to make it hers. I would like nothing better than to lay eyes on the sword. All Innis talks of it, Eid said. Will you show it to me, lady? Kaliba chuckled low.
If I had it, I would be happy indeed. I searched for Ascalon for centuries, but Galleon hid it well.
He left no clue as to its whereabouts.
Only that he meant to leave it in the hands of those who would die to keep it from me.
Her smile faded.
The queens of Innis have also sought it, given that it is sacred to them. But they will not find it. If I could not, then no one will.
That Kaliba had forged Ascalon for Galleon Barethnet was common knowledge in the Priory. It was part of the reason many sisters had distrusted her. The two of them had been born in the same era and had both lived in or around the village of Goldenbirch. But beyond those scant facts, no one understood the nature of their relationship. Queen Sabran dreamed of this bower of eternity, Eid said. While I was her lady-in-waiting, she told me so. Only you can weave dreams, lady. Was it you who sent them to her?
That knowledge, Kaliba said, will require a higher price.
With that, the witch slid from the boulder. Naked once more, she listed onto her side, and the rock beneath her transformed into a bed of flowers. They smelled of cream and honey.
Come to me. She smoothed a hand over her petals. Come. Lie with me in my bower, and I will sing to you of dreaming.
Lady, Eid said, I desire nothing more than to please you and to prove my loyalty, but my heart belongs to another.
The secret of dream weaving must surely be worth the price of one night. It has been centuries since I felt the soft touch of a lover.
Kaliba drew a finger down her own abdomen, stopping just shy of where her thighs met.
But I do admire loyalty. So I will accept another gift from you, in exchange for my knowledge of the stars and their gifts.
Anything.
20 years they have kept me from the orange tree. Once a mage has tasted of the fire, she burns for it evermore. The hunger eats me from within. I would very much like my flame back.
Kaliba held her gaze.
Bring me the fruit, and you will be my heir. Swear it to me, Eadaz Duzala Uknara. Swear that you will bring me what I desire.
Lady, Eid said, I swear it by the mother. And she said nothing about the jewels, the prioress said. Only that she did not make them? Eid stood in her sunroom, facing her. Yes, prioress, she said, Ascalon is her only creation. I thought it best not to mention the jewels, for fear she would pursue them. Good. Chassa was grim-faced. The prioress placed her hands on the balustrade, and her ring glinted in the sun. 2 strands of magic. I have never heard anything of the sort, she breathed in. I mislike this. The witch is a liar by nature. There is a reason they called her Rattletongue.
She might embellish the truth, Chassa said, but bloodthirsty and cold though she is, she never struck me as a liar. In her day, in Iniska, there were brutal punishments for oath-breaking.
You forget, Chassar, that she lied about Zala. She claimed she never poisoned her, but only an outsider would have murdered a sister.
Chassar dropped his gaze.
The jewels must be Sterin, Eid said, even if Kaliba did not make them. If they are not our kind of magic, they must be the other.
The prioress nodded slowly. I vowed to her that I would bring her the fruit. Is she like to pursue me when I do not?
I doubt she will squander her magic on a hunt. In Inikius, you are protected here.
The prioress watched the sun descend. Say nothing of this to your sisters. Our next line of inquiry is this Naporo.
An Easterner, Eid said quietly. Surely that tells you that the mother was interested in the world beyond the south.
I tire of this subject, Eadaz.
Eid bit her tongue. Chassa shot her a cautionary look.
If Naporo spoke true, then to defeat our enemy, we will need both Ascalon and the jewels.
The prioress rubbed her temple.
Leave me, Eadaz. I must... consider our course." Eid inclined her head and left. In her sunroom, Eid found Arilak snoozing at the foot of her bed, weary from their journey. She sat on the bed beside him and stroked his silken ears. They twitched in his sleep. Her mind was a crucible of stars and fire. The Nameless One would return, and the Priory only had one of the three instruments needed to destroy him. With every hour that passed, the danger grew in Virtudom, and Sabran was at greater risk. Meanwhile, Sagosa Vitalda was building his invasion fleet in Qual Bay. A divided West would not be ready for the Flesh King. Eid pressed close to Arilak and closed her eyes. Somehow she had to find a way to help her. "Eidas," she looked up. A woman stood in the doorway. Tight curls wreathed her brown face and tumbled into tawny eyes. "Nairouge," Theod said, rising. They had been rivals when they were children. Nairouge had always been vying with Jondu for the attention of the prioress, which Eid, loving Jondu as her elder sister, had taken very much to heart. Now, however, Eid took Nairouge by the hands and kissed her on the cheek. "It is good to see you," Eid said. "You honor the cloak. And you have honored us all by shielding Sabran for so long. I confess, I laughed to see you shipped off to that ludicrous court when I was young and foolish," Nairouge said with a wry smile. "But I understand now that we all work in different ways for the mother."
"I see you are serving her as we speak," Eid returned her smile. "You must be close to your time."
"Any day now,"
Nairouge placed a hand on her belly.
"I've come to prepare you for your initiation into the Red Damsels."
Eid felt her smile growing.
"Tonight?"
"Yes, tonight," Nairouge chuckled.
"Did you think that after you banished Fyadel, you would not be raised at once when you returned?"
She guided Eid to a chair. A boy came in and set down a tray before retreating. Eid folded her hands in her lap. Her heart had the wings of a flock of birds. For one night, she would put aside what she had learned from Kaliba. She would forget everything that had happened outside these walls. Since she was old enough to understand who she was, she had known that she was destined to be a Red Damsel. Her dream was here. She meant to savor it.
"For you," Nairouge handed her a cup. "From the Prioress."
Eid sipped. "Mother," a weave of sweet flavors unspooled on her tongue.
"What is this?" "Sun wine, from Kumenga. The Prioress keeps a supply," Nairouge whispered. "Talgas in the kitchen sometimes lets me have a taste. He'll let you have one too, if you say I sent you. Just don't tell the prioress."
"Never." Eid drank again. It tasted exquisite. Nairouge took a wooden comb from the tray.
"Eidas," she said, "I wanted to give you my condolences for Jondu. We had our differences, but I respected her very much."
"Thank you," Eid said softly. She shook her head to clear the sadness. "Come then, Nairouge. Tell me everything that has happened these past 8 years."
"I will," Nairouge said, tapping the comb against her palm. "If you promise to me all the secrets of the Inish court."
She reached for a bowl of oil.
"I hear life there is like walking on coals, that the courtiers climb over one another to get close to the queen, that there is more intrigue in the court of Sabran the Ninth than there is Skystone in Rumalabar."
Eid looked towards the window. The stars were coming out.
"Truly," she said, "you have no idea."
As Nairouge worked on Eid, she told her about the steady waking of worms in the south and how the Red Damsels were working harder by the day to deal with the threat. King Jantar and High Ruler Kagudo, the only sovereigns who knew of the Priory, had asked for more sisters to be posted in their cities and courts. Meanwhile, the menfolk of the Priory, who dealt with domestic matters, might soon have to be trained as slayers. In return, Eid told her the more preposterous facets of Innis. The petty enmities between courtiers and lovers and poets, her time as a maid of honour under Oliver Marchin, the quacks who gave out dung for a fever and leeches for a headache, the 18 dishes presented to Sabran every morning, of which she ate one.
"And Sabran? Is she as capricious as they say?" Nairouge asked. "I hear that in one morning she can be as jubilant as a parade, as sad as a lament, and as angry as a wildcat."
Eid did not reply for a long time. "That is true," she finally said.
arose behind a pillow, hands on the virginals, her laugh as they had raced after the hunt.
I suppose a little caprice is to be expected of a woman born to sit on such a throne at such a price.
Nairouge patted her belly.
This is heavy enough without the fiat of nations perched on top of it.
The hour of the ceremony drew near. Iyad let Nairouge and three other sisters help her into her vestures. Once her hair was arranged, they adorned it with a circlet of orange blossoms. They slid bracelets of glass and gold up her arms. Finally, Nairouge took her by the shoulders.
Ready?
Iyad nodded. She had been ready all her life.
I envy you, Nairouge said. The task the prioress will give your next sounds.
Task? Iyad looked at her. What task? Nairouge fluttered a hand.
I must not see any more. You will know soon enough.
She took Iyad by the arm.
Come.
They led her to the tomb of the mother. The burial chamber had been lit with 120 candles. The number of people who had been sacrificed by lottery to the Nameless One before Cleolind had ended the rule of the blood at last. The prioress was waiting in front of a statue. Every sister not posted elsewhere was here to see the daughter of Zala take her place as a red damsel. Ceremonies were succinct affairs in the priory. Cleolind had not wanted the pomp and circumstance of courts for her handmaidens. Intimacy was what mattered, the coming together of sisters in support and praise of one another. In the womb-like darkness of the chamber, with the mother gazing down at them all, Iyad felt closer to her than she ever had. Chassa stood to the left of the prioress. He looked as proud as if he were her birth father. Iyad knelt.
Eadaz Dozala Uknara, the prioress said. Her voice echoed. You have served the mother faithfully and without question. We welcome you, as our sister and friend, to the ranks of the Red Damsels.
I am Eadaz Dozala Uknara, Iyad said. I pledge myself anew to the mother, as I did once as a child.
May she keep your blade sharp and your cloak red with blood, the sisters said together, and may the Nameless One fear your light.
It was traditional for the birth mother to present a sister with her cloak. In the absence of Zala, it was Chassa who hung it around her shoulders. He fastened it with a brooch at the hollow of her throat, and when he cupped her cheek, Iyad returned his smile. She held out her right hand. The prioress slid on her silver ring, topped with the five-petaled flower of sunstone, the ring she had imagined herself wearing all her life.
May you go forth into the world, the prioress said, and stand against the ruthless fire, now and always.
Iyad drew the brocade close to her skin. The richness of the red was impossible to fabricate. Only draconic blood could stain it so. The prioress held out both her hands, palms up, and smiled. Iyad took them and rose, and applause rang through the burial chambers. As the prioress turned her to face her sisters, presenting her to them as a red damsel, Iyad happened to look towards the sons of Siati. And there, standing among them, was a man whose face was familiar. He was taller than she was, long, powerful limbs, deep black skin. When he lifted his head, his features were bared to the candlelight. She could not be seeing this. Kaliba had addled her senses. He was dead. He was lost. He could not be here. And yet he was. Loth.
Chapter 44. South.
Iyad. She was staring at him as if at a ghost. For months he had walked these halls in a half-sleep. He suspected they were putting something into his food to make him forget the man he had been. He had started to misremember the details of her face, his friend from far away. Now there she was, cloaked in red, hair thick-set with flowers, and she looked whole and full and fire new, as if she had gone for too long without water and now she was in bloom. Iyad shifted her gaze, as if she had never seen him. The prioress, the head of this sect, guided her from the chamber. Betrayal had stung him at the first sight of her, but he had known, from that instant of flared eyes and parted lips, that she was just as surprised to see him as he was to see her. No matter what she was still Iyad Durian, still his friend. Somehow, he had to reach her, before it was too late to remember. Chassar was in bed when Iyad found him reading by candlelight, spectacles on the bridge of his nose. He looked up as she blew into his chamber like a storm. "What is Lord Archaloth doing here?" She made no effort to keep her voice low. His great brows furrowed. "Iyadaz," he said, "calm yourself." Sarson, who had been snoozing, loosed an indignant call. "The Nighthawk sent Loth to Cascaro," Iyad said coolly. "Why is he here?" Chassar let out a long sigh. "He was the one who brought us the riddle box. It is given to him by the Dunmata Morosa." He removed his spectacles. "She told him to find me, after meeting Jandu."
"The Dunmata is an ally?"
"Apparently." Chassar crossed his nightrobe over his chest and knotted the belt. "Lord Archaloth was not meant to be in the burial chamber tonight."
"Then you purposely kept him out of my way?"
The deceit would have hurt from anyone, but it was most hurtful from him.
"I knew that you would not be pleased," Chassar murmured. "I wanted to break it to you myself after the ceremony. You know that when outsiders find the priory, they can never leave."
"He has a family. We cannot just..."
"We can. For the priory." Slowly, Chassar rose from bed. "If we let him go, he would tell all to Sabran."
"You need not fear that. The Nighthawk will never let Loth return to court," Iyad said.
"Iyadaz, listen to me. Archaloth Beck is a follower of the Deceiver. Perhaps he was kind to you, but he can never understand you. Next you will tell me that you came to care for Sabran Bereth. What if I did?"
Chassar scrutinized her face. His mouth was a fess in the depths of his beard.
"You heard the blasphemy of the Inish," he said. "You know what they have done to the memory of the mother.
You told me to get close to her. Is it any wonder if I did?"
Iyad shot back. "You left me to fend for myself in that court for almost a decade. I was an outsider, a convert. If I had not found people to hold on to make the wait endurable..."
"I know, and I will be sorry for it for the rest of my days."
He laid a tender hand on her shoulder.
"You are tired and angry. We can speak again in the morning."
She wanted to retort, but this was Chassar, who had helped the sons of Sayati raise her, who had made her gurgle with laughter when she was small, who had watched over her when Zala had died.
"Nairuj told me that the prioress would give me another task soon," Iyad said. "I want to know what it is."
Chassar pressed a finger between his eyes and rubbed. She stood akimbo, waiting. "You shielded Sabran from Fyadel almost 9 years after leaving Lassia. That deep bond with the tree, one that can reach across time and distance, is a rare thing. Very rare." He sank back onto the bed. "The prioress means to take advantage of it. She intends to send you to the lands beyond the Gate of Ungulus."
Her heart thumped. "For what purpose?"
"A sister brought us rumors from Dreasta. A group of pirates are claiming Helvisa laid an egg somewhere in the area during the Grief of Ages," Chassar said. "The prioress wants you to find and destroy it before it can hatch."
"Ungulus?"
Iyad could no longer feel most of her body.
"I might be away for years."
"Yes. The Gate of Ungulus was the edge of the known world. Beyond it, the southern continent was uncharted. The few explorers who had ventured there had spoken of a waste without end, which was named the area. Glittering salt flats, brutal sun, and not a drop of water. If any of them had made it to the other side, they had never returned to tell the tale."
"There have always been stories circulating, Dreasta."
Iyad walked slowly towards the balcony.
"By the mother, what have I done to deserve more exile?"
"This is a mission of true urgency," Chassar said. "But I sense she chose you for it, not only because of your endurance, but because this task would return your attention to the south."
"You mean my loyalty is in question?"
"No," Chassar said, gentler. "She simply believes you might benefit from this journey. It will give you a chance to remember your purpose and cleanse yourself of impurities." The prioress wanted her as far away from Virtudom as possible, so she would not be able to see the turmoil that would soon break out there. She hoped that by the time Iyad returned, she would no longer believe that anywhere but the south mattered.
"There is one other choice." Iyad looked over her shoulder.
"Out with it."
"You could offer her a child."
Chassar held her gaze. "We must have more warriors for the priory. The prioress believes any child of yours will inherit your bond with the tree. Do this, and she may send Nairuj south instead, once she has given birth." Her jaw hurt from the effort it took to rein in a joyless laugh. "For me," she said, "that is no choice." She strode from the room. "Eadaz!" Chassa called after her, but she did not look back. "Where are you going?" "To see her." "No." He was down the corridor and in front of her in moments. "Eadaz, look at me. The decision is made. Fight her, and she will only extend your time away."
"I am not a child that I need to be sent away to think about what I have done wrong. I am..."
"What is happening?"
Ea turned. The prioress, resplendent in plum-coloured silk, stood at the entrance to the corridor. "Prioress," Ead went to her, "I beg you not to send me on this assignment beyond Angulus."
"It is already arranged. We have long suspected that the High Westerns have a nest," the prioress said.
"The sister who goes to destroy it must be able to survive without the fruit. I have confidence that you will do this for me, daughter, that you will serve the mother once again."
"This is not how I was meant to serve the mother. You will accept nothing but my allowing you to return to Innis. You have your heart set upon this. You must go past the gate of Angelus to remember who you are."
"I know full well who I am," Ead snapped. "What I do not know is why, in the years I have been absent, this house of ours has become unable to see beyond its nose."
She knew from the silence that followed that she had gone too far. The prioress looked at her for a long time. So still, she might as well have been cast from bronze.
"If you ask to eschew your duty again," she said at last, "I will have no choice but to take back your cloak."
Ead could not speak. A coldness ran her through. The prioress shut herself in her sunroom. Chassar gave Ead a rueful look before he walked away, leaving her to stand and tremble. A society this old and this secret needed careful handling. She, Eadaz Duzala Uknara, now knew what it felt like to be handled. Her journey back to her room was a smear. She strode out onto her balcony and beheld the veil of blood once more. The orange tree was as beautiful as ever, soul-fearing in its perfection. The prioress would not stop the fall of Innis. One civil war took Virtudom apart from within. It would be easy prey for the flesh king of the draconic army. Ead could not stomach it. The sun wine was still on her nightstand. She drank what was left, trying to steady the quivers of anger. When she had drained the cup, she found herself gazing at it, and as she turned it over in her hands, something woke in her memory. The twin goblets, the age-old symbol of the Knight of Justice, and her bloodline, Crest. Descendant of the Knight of Justice, she who weighed the cups of guilt and innocence, of support and opposition, of virtue and vice, a trusted servant of the crown. Cupbearer. Igraine Crest, who had always disapproved of Albrechtly Evelyn, whose retainers had seized control of the Queen Tower, even as Ead fled from it, ostensibly to protect Sabran. Ead gripped the balustrade. Loth had sent one warning from Cascaro. Beware the cupbearer. He had been investigating the disappearance of Prince Wilston, who in turn had suspected the Vatalda of involvement in the murder of Queen Rosarion. Had Crest arranged for Rosarion Berethnet to die before her time, leaving a young girl in charge of Innis, a queen who needed a protector before she came of age? A young Princess Crest had stepped in to mould. Even as she considered it, Ea knew her instinct had struck true. She had been so blinded by her hatred for Combe, so determined to make him responsible for everything that had happened in Innis, she had missed what had been right before her eyes.
"How easy it would be," Combe had said, "for you to lay the blame for all ills at my doorstep."
If it was Crest, then Roslane could be in on it. Perhaps her loyalty to Sabran had gone, along with the child. The entire Crest family could be plotting to usurp her. And they had the Queen Tower. Ead paced in the dark. Despite the wet heat of the Lassian Basin, she was so cold that her jaw quaked. If she returned to Innis, she would be an anathema to the Priory. Her name unsaid, her life forfeit. If she did not return to Innis, she would be abandoning all of Virtudom. That seemed to Ead to be a betrayal of all she knew to be right and all the Priory represented. She was loyal to the mother, not to Mita Yadanya. She had to follow the flame in her heart, the flame the tree had given her. The realization of what she had to do carved pieces from her soul. She tasted salt on her lips. Tears ran down to her chin and fell in fat drops.
This place was where she had been born. It was where she belonged. All she had ever wanted all her life was a red cloak, the cloak she would have to leave behind. She would continue the work of the mother. In Innes, she could end what Jondu had started. Ascalon. Without the sword, there was no chance of defeating the Nameless One. The Red Damsels had searched for it. Caliba had searched for it, to no avail. None of them had possessed the waning jewel. Both forms of magic are drawn to themselves most of all, but also to the other. The jewel had to be Steren. Ascalon might answer to it, and it, in turn, would answer only to her. Eid gazed out at the tree, throat aching. She sank to her knees, and she prayed that this was the right decision. Arilak found her there in the morning, when the sun burned in the pearl-blue sky.
Eidaz.
She turned her head to look at him, raw and sleepless. His tongue sanded her cheek. My friend, she said, I need your help. She took his face between her hands. Do you remember how I fed you when you were a pup? How I cared for you? His amber eyes seemed to catch the sunlight.
Yes,
he said. Of course he remembered. Ichneumons did not forget the first hand to feed them. There is a man here, among the sons of Siati. His name is Artaloth.
Yes, I brought him here.
You are right to see of him. She swallowed the thickness in her throat. I need you to get him out of the priory, to the mouth of the cave in the forest, after sundown. He studied her.
You are leaving?
I must. His slit nostrils flared.
They will follow.
Which is why I need your help. She stroked his ears. You must discover where the prioress keeps the white jewel from my chamber.
You are a fool.
He nudged her brow with his nose.
Without the tree you will wither. All sisters do.
Then wither I will. Better to do that than to do nothing. A huff escaped him.
Mita has the jewel on her person, he rumbled. She smells of it, of the sea.
Eid closed her eyes. I will find a way, she said. Chapter 45 East. The beaches of Feather Island were overrun by seawater. Tane had spent hours with Eldevara while the island shivered, making it impossible to read. Eldevara had managed, of course. The world could end and he would find a way to keep on reading. After the waters, a terrible hush had fallen. Every bird in the forest had lost its voice. That was when the scholars began to examine the damage wrought by the quake. Most of their number were unscathed, but two men had been tossed from the cliffs. The sea had not returned their bodies, but another body had washed up a day later. The body of a dragon. Tane had gone with Eldevara at sunset to look upon the lifeless god. The steps were hard on his iron leg, and it had taken them a long time to reach the beach, but he had been resolved to go, and Tane had not left his side. They had found a young Cycanese dragon twisted across the sand, her jaw slack in death. Birds had already pecked the gleam from her scales, and mist clung to her bones. Tane had shuddered at the sight, and eventually, when she could bear it no more, she had turned away in grief. She had never seen the carcass of a dragon. It was the most terrible thing she had ever beheld. They had thought at first that the little female had been butchered in Kawante, and the remains abandoned to the sea. Tane had thought of Naimathun and sickened, but the body had been whole, with all its scales and teeth and claws. Gods could not drown. They were one with water. Finally, the elders had concluded that this dragon had been boiled. Boiled alive by the sea itself. Nothing was more unnatural. No omen could be more sinister. Even if all the scholars had combined their strength, they would not be able to move the dragon. She would be left to thaw out of existence. Eventually, all that remained would be iridescent bone. The surgeon arrived while Tane was sweeping leaves with three other scholars, who worked in silence. Some shook with tears. The dead dragon had left everyone in a state of shock.
Scholar Tane, Eldevara called.
She walked behind him like a shadow into the corridors.
The surgeon has come at last. I thought she might examine your side, he said. The learned Dr. Moyaka is a practitioner of Cycanese and Mentish medicine.
Tane stopped dead. Moyaka? She knew that name. Eldevara turned to face her with a cockled brow.
Scholar Tane, you look distressed. I don't want to see this doctor. Please, learned Eldavara. Dr. Moyaka has... She felt sick. He knows someone who threatened me, who threatened my dragon. She could see Roos again, on the beach. His callous smile as he told her she must mutilate her dragon or lose everything. Moyaka had let that monster stay in his house.
I know your last days in Psyche were unhappy, Tene. Eldavara spoke gently. I also know how hard it is to let go of the past. But on Feather Island, you must let go.
Tane stared at his lined face. What do you know? She whispered.
Everything.
Who else knows?
Only myself and the honored High Elder.
His words made her feel as if she had been stripped naked. Deep down, she had hoped the governor of Ginuru would tell no one why she had been sent away from Psyche.
If you are certain you do not want to see learned Dr. Moyaka, Eldavara said, say it once more and I will take you to your room.
She had no desire whatsoever to see Dr. Moyaka, but she also had no wish to embarrass Eldavara by acting like a child.
I will see him, she said.
Her, Eldavara corrected.
A stout Psychonese woman awaited them in the healing room, where a water fountain burbled. Tane had never seen her before, but she was plainly a relative of the Dr. Moyaka she had met in Ganura.
Good day, honorable scholar, the woman bowed. I understand you have an injury to your side.
An old one, Eldavara explained, when Tane only bowed in return. It is a swelling she has had since childhood.
I see. The learned Moyaka patted the mats, where a blanket and a headrest had been placed.
Open your tunic, please, honorable scholar, and lie down.
Tane did as instructed.
Tell me, Purume, Eldavara said to the doctor, have there been any more attacks in Psyche by the fleet of the Tiger Eye?
Not since the night they came to Ginura, to my knowledge, Moyaka replied heavily. But they will soon return. The Golden Empress is emboldened.
It took Tane all her willpower not to shrink from her touch. The lump was still tender.
Ah, here it is.
Moyaka traced the shape of the lump.
How many years have you taken, honorable scholar?
20, Tane said softly.
And you have had this all your life?
Since I was a child. My learned teacher said my rib was broken once.
Does it ever hurt?
Sometimes.
Moyaka probed it with two fingertips.
From the feel of it, it is most likely a bone spur, nothing to be concerned about. But I would like to make a small incision, just to be sure.
She opened a leather case. Will you need something for the pain? The old Tane would have refused, but all she had wanted since arriving here was to feel nothing, to forget herself. One of the younger scholars brought ice from the caves, wrapped in wool to keep it cold. Moyaka prepared the drug, and Tane drank it in through a pipe. The smoke rubbed her throat raw. When it reached her chest, it blew a dark, sweet comfort through her blood, and her body was half feather and half stone, sinking as her thoughts grew light. The weight of her shame evaporated. For the first time in weeks, she breathed easy. Moyaka held the ice to her side. Once Tane could no longer feel much there, the doctor selected an instrument, washed it in boiled water, and glided its edge beneath the lump. A far-off pain registered, the shadow of pain. Tane pressed her palms to the floor.
Are you well, child? Eldavara asked.
There were three of him. Tane nodded, and the world seemed to nod with her. Moyaka peeled the incision open.
This is...
She blinked.
Strange. Very strange.
Tane tried to raise her head, but her neck was weak as a blade of grass. Eldavara placed a hand on her shoulder.
What is it, Purume?
I can't be sure until I remove it, was the puzzled reply. But, well, it almost looks like a...
Her finding was cut off by a shattering crash from outside.
Another earthshake, Eldavara said. His voice sounded so far away.
That did not feel like an earthshake, Moyaka stiffened.
Great Quiriki, save us! A glow burst through the window. The floor trembled and someone shouted, fire! Moments later, the same voice let out a spine-chilling scream before it cut off sharply.
Fire breathers. Eldavara was already on his feet.
Tane, quickly, we must take shelter in the ravine.
Fire breathers. But no fire breathers had been seen in the east for centuries. He pulled her arm around his bony shoulders and lifted her from the mats. Tane swayed. Her mind was spindrift, but she had kept enough sense to move. Shoeless and numbed, she went with Eldevara and Dr. Moyaka through the corridors and into the dining hall, where he slid open the door to the courtyard. Other scholars were making for the forest. The smells of rain and fire mingled around her. Eldevara pointed to the bridge. "Go across. There is a cave on the other side. Wait for me inside and we will climb down together," Eldevara said. "Dr. Moyaka and I must see that no one has been left behind." He gave her a push. "Go, Tane. Hurry." "And keep pressure on the wound," Dr. Moyaka called after her. Everything moved as if through water. Tane broke into a loose-footed run, but she felt like she was wading. The bridge was within sight of Vane Hall. She was closing on it when a shadow winged above her. Heat flared against her back. She tried to go faster, but exhaustion made her blunder, and, with every step, the incision wept more blood. Pain beat at the padded armor the drug had wrapped around her. The bridge crossed the ravine near the falls of Quiriki. An elder was already shepherding a cluster of scholars over it. Tane stumbled after them, one hand pressed to her side. Beneath the bridge was a fatal drop to the path of the elder. Treetops rose from a bowl of fog. Another shadow fell from above. She tried to shout a warning to the other scholars, but her tongue was a wad of cloth in her mouth. A fireball slammed into the roof of the bridge. Seconds later, a spiked tail turned it to an explosion of splinters. Wood groaned and split underfoot. Tane almost fell as she stopped herself running onto it. Powerless, she watched as the structure tumbled, a gaping hole ripped through its middle. A third fire breather smashed out of the pillars that anchored it. Faceless silhouettes cried out as they slid off the edge and plummeted. Flame ripped through flesh and timber alike. Another section of the bridge crumbled away, like a log that had been ablaze for too long. Wind howled in the wake of wings. There was no choice. She would have to jump. Tane ran onto the bridge, eyes stinging in the smoke as the fire breathers wheeled for a second attack. Before she could reach the gap, her knees folded. She rolled to break her fall, and her skin ripped open like wet paper. Sobbing in agony, she reached for her side, and the lump, the thing she had carried for years, slipped from the burst seam in her body. Shuddering, she looked at it. A jewel, slick with her blood, and no larger than a chestnut. A star imprisoned in a stone. There was no time to be bewildered. More fire breathers were flocking. Weak with pain, Tane closed her hand around the jewel. As she struggled across the bridge, dizzier by the moment, something crashed through the roof and landed in front of her. She found herself face to face with a nightmare. It looked and smelled like the remnant of a volcanic eruption. Burning coals where there ought to be eyes, scales as black as cinder. Steam hissed where rain stippled its hide. Two muscular legs took most of its weight, and the joints of its wings ended in cruel hooks. And those wings, the wings of a bat, a lizard tail whipped behind. Even with its head lowered, it towered over her, teeth bared and bloodstained. Tane shivered under its gaze. She had no sword or halberd, not even a dagger to put out its eye. Once she might have prayed, but no god would hearken to a rider in disgrace. The fire breather screamed a challenge. Light scorched in its throat, and Tane came to the detached realization that she was about to die. Eldevara would find her smoking ruins, and that would be the end of it. She did not fear death. Dragon riders put themselves in mortal danger every day, and since she was a child, she had known the risks she would face when she joined Clan Medushi. An hour ago, she might even have embraced this end, better than the spun-out rot of shame. Yet, when instinct told her to hold out the jewel, to fight to the last with whatever she had, she obeyed. It burned white cold against her palm as she thrust it at the beast. Blinding light erupted from inside it. She held a moonrise in her hand. With a scream, the fire breather recoiled from the glare. Throwing up a wing to shield its face, it let out a rasping call, over and over, like a crow greeting the dusk. The sky came alive with echoing answers. She stepped closer, still holding out the jewel. With a final look of hatred, the fire breather roared once more, whipping her hair back from her face and flung itself skyward. As it veered towards the sea, its kin swerved after it and disappeared into the night. The other side of the bridge crumbled into the ravine, throwing up a cloud of cinders, her eyes filled. Weak with pain, she crawled back towards Vane Hall. One half of her tunic was red through.
She buried the jewel in the soil of the courtyard. Whatever it was, she had to keep it hidden, as she had all her life. The roof of the healing room was staved in. She searched the wet mats for Moyaka's case and found it upturned in the corner. Close to the bottom was a coil of gut string and a bent needle. The drugging pipe had been shattered. When she lifted her hand from the wound, blood pulsed out. With clumsy fingers, she threaded the needle. She cleaned the cut as best she could, but dirt clung to its edges. Touching it made darkness blotch her vision. Head spinning, mouth dry, she groped in the case of oddities again and found an amber bottle. The worst was yet to come. She had to stay awake, just for a little longer. Nyamathan and Souza had suffered because of her. Now it was her turn. The needle pierced her skin. Chapter 46. South. The kitchens were behind the waterfall, just below the sunrooms. As a child, Eid had loved to sneak in with Jondu and purloin rose candles from Tulgus, the head cook. The scullery was sun-dappled and always smelled of spices. The servants were preparing jeweled rice, scallions, and chicken in a lime marinade for the evening meal. She found Loth arranging a platter of fruit with Tulgus. His eyelids looked heavy. Dreamroot. They must be trying to make him forget.
"Good afternoon, sister," said the white-haired cook.
Eid smiled, trying not to look at Loth.
"Do you remember me, Tulgus?"
"I do, sister,"
he returned the smile.
"I certainly remember how much of my food you stole."
His eyes were the pale yellow of groundnut oil. Perhaps he was the one who had gifted Nairuj her eyes.
"I have grown up since then. Now I ask for it."
Eid lowered her voice and leaned closer.
"Nairuj said you might let me taste a little of the prioress's sun wine."
"Hmm."
Tulgus wiped his liver-spotted chin on a cloth.
"A small glass. Call it a homecoming gift from the sons of Siati. I will have it brought to your chamber.
Thank you."
Loth was looking at her as if at a stranger. It took Eid all her strength not to meet his gaze. As she walked back towards the doorway, she spied the urns where herbs and spices were stored. Seeing that Tulgus was preoccupied, Eid found the jar she needed, took a generous pinch of the powder, and dropped it into a pouch. She snatched a honey pastry from a platter before she left. It would be a long time before she tasted another. For the rest of the day, she did as any good red damsel would do when she was about to be sent on a long journey. She practiced her archery under the watchful eyes of the silver damsels. Each of her arrows found its mark. Between draws, Eid made certain to look calm, unhurried about knocking her arrows. One bead of sweat could give her away. When she reached her sunroom, she found it empty of her saddlebags and weapons. Aralak must have taken them. A cold feeling came over her. This was it. The point of no return. She pulled in a breath, and her spine turned to iron. The mother would not have watched while the world burned. Crushing the last embers of doubt, Eid changed into her nightrobe and took up her position on the bed, where she pretended to read. Outside, the light of day withdrew. Loth and Aralak would be waiting for her by now. When it was full dark and a knock came at her door, she called, "Come in." One of the menfolk entered, bearing a platter. On it were two cups and a jug.
"Tolga said you wished to taste the sun wine, sister," he said.
"Yes," she motioned to the nightstand. "Leave it here, and open the doors if you will." When he set down the tray, Eid kept her expression clean and leafed past another page in her book. As he shuffled towards the balcony doors, she slipped the pouch of dreamroot from her sleeve and emptied it into one of the cups. By the time the man turned back, she had the other cup in her hand, and the pouch was nowhere to be seen. He took the tray and left. Wind rushed through the sunroom and blew out the oil lamp. Eid dressed in her travel clothes and boots, still sandy from the burla. The prioress would be drinking the drugged wine by now. She took the only knife she had not already packed and sheathed it at her thigh. When she was certain that there was no one outside, she pulled her hood over her eyes and became one with the dark. The prioress slept in the highest sunroom in the priory, close to the crest of the waterfall, where she could see the dawn break over the veil of blood. Eid stopped at the arched entrance to the passageway. Two red damsels guarded the door. What she did next was a delicate thing, an ancient skill no longer taught in the priory.
Candling, Jondu had called it, lighting the smallest flame imaginable within a living body, just enough to cause the loss of breathing. It required a nimbleness of touch. With the slightest twist of her fingers, she struck one candle in each of the women. It had been a long time since a sister had turned against her kith. The twins were unprepared to feel the dry heat in their throats. Smoke curled from their mouths and noses and shot black tendrils through their minds, smothering their senses. As they sank, Iyad moved past on silent foot and listened at the door. All was quiet. Inside, moonlight made needles through the windows. She stood in the deep shadows. The prioress was in bed, surrounded by veils. The cup was on the nightstand. Iyad approached, heart thumping, and looked inside it. Empty. Her gaze slid towards the prioress. Sweat trembled at the very end of a coil of hair above her eyes. It took a moment to find the jewel. The prioress had pressed it into soft clay and hung it from a cord around her neck. You must think me a fool. A chill took Iyad through her gut, like a thrown spear. The prioress turned onto her back. I sensed somehow that I should not drink the wine tonight, a premonition from the mother. Her hand closed around the jewel. I suppose this rebellion in you is not all your fault. It was inevitable that Innes would poison you. Iyad dared not move. You mean to return there, to protect the pretender, the prioress said. Your birth mother moves in you. Zala also believed that we should stretch our limited resources to protect all humankind. She was always whispering in the ear of the old prioress, telling her that we ought to protect every sovereign in every court, even in the east, where they worship the worms of the sea, where they idolize them as gods, just as the nameless one would have had us do to him. Oh yes, Zala would have had us protect them too. Something about her tone sat wrong with Iyad. The hatred in it. The mother loved the south. It is the south she sought to shield from the nameless one, she continued, and it is the south I am sworn to protect in her name. Zala would have had us open our arms to the world, and in doing so, expose our bellies to the sword.
All because Mita Yedanya told her I had poisoned your birth, mother.
Kaliba had worn a mocking smile.
As if I would ever stoop to poison.
Mita had banished the witch and never allowed her to return. An outsider, after all, was an easy scapegoat. It was not the witch who killed Zala. He had closed a hand around her blade, and it nerved her. It was you! She was cold to her bones. The prioress raised her eyebrows.
Whatever can you mean, Eardas?
You hated that Zala looked to defend the world beyond the south. Hated her influence. You knew it would only intensify when she was named prioress. Gooseflesh tightened her skin. To control the priory, you had to be rid of her.
I did it for the mother.
The confession was as blunt as the rest of her.
Murderer, Iyad whispered. You murdered a sister.
Honey pastries, warm embraces. All her vague memories of Zala flooded back and heat swelled to her eyelids.
To protect my sisters and to ensure the South always had the protection it needed, I was willing to do anything.
With a sigh that was almost exasperated, the prioress sat up.
I gave her a quiet death. Most had condemned Kaliba before I had even opened my mouth. It was an insult to the mother that she came here, she who loved the deceiver well enough to forge the sword for him. She is our enemy.
Iyad could scarcely hear her. For the first time in her life, she felt the draconic fire in her blood. Rage was a furnace in her belly, and its roar overwhelmed all other sounds. The jewel. Give it to me and I will leave in peace. Her voice was distant to her own ears. I can use it to find Ascalon. Let me finish what Jandu began and protect the integrity of Virtudom, and I will not speak a word of your offense. Someone will wield the jewel, was the reply, but it will not be you. The movement was as quick as a viper bite, too fast to avoid. White heat lashed across her skin. Iyad reeled back, one hand beneath her throat, where blood was welling thick and fast. The prioress slashed away the remnants of the veil. The blade in her hand was laced with red. Only death can change the wielder. Iyad looked at the blood on her fingers.
Do you mean to kill birth mother and child both?
I will not see a gift from the mother in the hands of one who would desert her so willingly, Mita said, calmly.
The jewel will remain beneath her bones until the Nameless One threatens the people of the South. It will not be used to protect a Western pretender. She lifted the knife in a fluid movement, like a rising note of music.
No, Eadaz,